Hello everyone, and welcome to the ACTIS podcast, a bi-weekly program dedicated to bringing you closer to the difference makers in CDI and sharing the latest news relevant to the CDI profession and to ACTIS. My name is Rebecca Hendren and I'm the director of ACTIS. I am your host for today's program, which is part of our occasional ACTIS advisory board series, where we're joined by members of the board to discuss hot topics in CDI. And today, I'm excited to tell you that we're going to be talking about Ehlers-Danlos comorbidities. And my guests are Amy Kratochvil, RHIT, CDIP, CCDS, System Director for HIM Coding and CDI at UChicago Medicine in Chicago, and also Tiara Miner, RN, BSN, CCDS, Director of CDI at the University of Miami Health System in Miami, Florida. Quick update before we get to our conversation. As a reminder, we have changed the CEU policy. We now offer 0.5 ACTIS CEUs for each episode, starting from the episode's release until 11 p.m. Eastern on the Sunday following an episode's release. So you have two more days than previously when the CEU cutoff was on Friday night. As a reminder, you can use these 0.5 ACTIS CEUs towards recertifying either your CCDS or CCDSO credential, or both if you have both. And I will tell you how to get those at the end of the show. Thank you so much for joining me, Amy and Tiara. I'm so glad to have you here to talk about this really interesting topic. So to kick things off, Tiara, I'm going to start with you. Could you please explain what Ehlers-Danlos comorbidities are, and how are they used?
Yep, I can start with that. So Ehlers-Danlos comorbidities are a set of conditions. There are 38 of them, some that overlap, but it's essentially 38 condition categories. When these are listed as secondary diagnoses, usually needing to be present on admission, they will represent your risk adjustment. So representing resource allocation, length of stay, or they're used for outcome predictions like in-hospital mortalities and readmissions. Those 38 conditions are mapped through the ICD-10 codes. So you don't necessarily report the condition. You just get credit for it once that ICD-10 code that's mapped to an Ehlers-Danlos is coded. So this data for your Ehlers-Danlos is captured through your claims data. It's really important for people to understand that the Ehlers-Danlos comorbidities themselves are not diagnoses. They are categories of conditions. So for example, you have weight loss as an Ehlers-Danlos comorbidity. Weight loss is not a diagnosis, but you will have the ICD-10 codes mapped, such as malnutrition, cachexia, or even the R code for abnormal weight loss. All of those are mapped to the Ehlers-Danlos comorbidity that's called weight loss. So by claiming any of those codes that map to that Ehlers-Danlos is where you would get the credit for capturing that Ehlers-Danlos comorbidity. So I hope that helps, because that's always a common question of the, you know, how they work and how do we use them. So Amy, do you have anything that you want to add to that?
Just that I think a lot of the Ehlers-Danlos comorbidities, when I look at the conditions that are listed, there's not a huge focus or any explicit focus on the pediatric population. So I think that's important to keep in mind too. But the Ehlers-Danlos comorbidities, if you, you know, do a quick Google search, they've been around for a long time and have been a long time predictor of in-house hospital mortality and 30-day all-cause readmission that Tiara noted as well.
That's really interesting. Thanks for explaining it. So how do scores or weights work in this system? Can you explain that?
Yeah, I can take that one. So each Ehlers-Danlos comorbidity is assigned a score or a weight, and that is used to help predict the overall mortality for that particular condition. And what's important to know if you look deep into the details of this and the reports is there's a risk of inpatient hospital mortality, and there's an index weight for each comorbidity measure. So there's some conditions that are highly associated with in-house mortality, and then there's some conditions that are not. They're not likely to lead to mortality. A good example is metastatic cancer. That is one of the highest weighted conditions that's associated with mortality for in-house deaths, whereas something like depression does not have a high correlation with in-hospital death. I don't know, Tiara, if you have some other good examples you want to throw in there.
No, those are really good. I would just add that some of the conditions are the same, but they use that hierarchy. So hypertension is one example of that. You're going to have your complicated hypertension and uncomplicated hypertension as two different Elix-Hauser comorbidities. You're only going to get credit for one of them, and you're going to want that to be, you know, like complicated is going to have a higher weight associated with it. Same thing for diabetes with complication, or even the liver disease. There's one score that's going to be for your mild liver disease, another that would be for moderate to severe liver disease, but they are different Elix-Hauser comorbidities within that list of 38 options. So just wanted to add that. But yes, I agree. Metastatic cancer is always the highest weighted.
Thank you. So my next question, you mentioned that some comorbidities have present on admission requirements. Could you elaborate on this and why POA status is important when you're working with Elix-Hauser comorbidities?
Yes. So most of the diagnoses require present on admission. And the instances that POA is not required, it's usually because there's some sort of presumption that is already included in the Elix-Hauser methodology that that condition was present on admission. For example, a patient with AIDS or cancer, those things don't develop during the hospital encounter. So the Elix-Hauser methodology, no matter what you put as the POA status on certain things, will automatically give you credit for it just because of the presumption in the logic. But for most of them, you do need to report them as present on admission in order to get credit for it.
I would just add some additional detail. When you look at the actual the list of the comorbidity descriptions, those 38, so 18 of those are dependent on the present on admission indicator. So essentially, to get credit for it, you have to report that it was yes, present at the time of the inpatient admission, or W for clinically undeterminable. So really important to keep in mind, because I know sometimes the documentation can be tricky and you're trying to decide, should this be present on admission or not? You know, this is where the query opportunities for POA can be impactful, because if the provider comes back and say it's clinically undeterminable, from an Elix-Hauser perspective, for those 18 conditions that are dependent on POA, you would still get credit for that. Whereas the other 20, these are the ones that Tiara mentioned, you know, the thought is that they're going to be pre-existing. So regardless of what you sign as the POA status, it's not going to matter. We're still going to get credit for that condition.
Thank you. So where can you find the official list of comorbidities? I was thinking it'd be really helpful for our podcast listeners if you could share how they can access this.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll make sure to put the link in our show notes for the podcast too. But if you go to the HCAP website, so the Healthcare Cost and Utilization Project website, they have all the files that you can download. They also include additional details like an overview of the Elix-Hauser comorbidity list, other resources that you might find helpful for your team, especially if this is new to you. But you can go there, download the Excel file, and have it available locally on your computer.
That's super helpful. And yes, we will put that direct link on the show notes for today's program.
I was just going to add that the lists updates after the fiscal year code updates happen. So usually around October or November, they will release a new file on that website. So you want to make sure that you're not using an old one, because they do change, you know, because it's based on the ICD-10 codes. So around every October, November timeframe, you want to recheck that website to make sure there hasn't been a new version released.
That's really good advice. Thank you.
Oh, and one more add for that, because I was looking at it closer the other day. They actually provide in a file that actually shows what's changed. So you can quickly see each year what new conditions may have been added, what may have been removed. So very important to always make sure you're taking a close look at what changes year to year, and then to share that with your team, because there could be new conditions added that maybe your team needs to consider for some of the comorbidities too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for clarifying. So now that we understand what Ehlers-Hauser comorbidities are and how they're coded, can you talk about why they matter? Like, what's the actual purpose behind tracking these comorbidities? And then how are they used?
Amy, do you want to start us with that one?
Yeah, for sure. So I know at our hospital, we got really involved with the Ehlers-Hausers when we started talking about the different risk adjustment, observed to expected mortality, and then more specifically, U.S. News and World Report. So I know a lot of organizations are focused on improving their rankings with U.S. News and World Report, you know, being part of that top honor roll where, you know, 20 hospitals are recognized across the country for being a top performer. Well, when you look at the details of the U.S. News and World Report, their actual methodology, which is publicly available, so that's something also we can include in the show notes, and you look at their best hospital specialty rankings, those are rankings for 12 data-driven specialties. And if you did not know this, about 30% of the actual rankings is based upon a 30-day mortality score. And now this can change year to year, as we know with any algorithm methodology, the logic is constantly changing and evolving. But for U.S. News and World Report, they do look very closely at that 30-day mortality score, and they actually use the Ehlers-Hauser comorbidity list to risk adjust patients. So it's very important if your facility is focused on U.S. News and World Report that you are capturing those Ehlers-Hauser conditions, again, especially those that are going to carry a higher score weight related to mortality, to make sure that you're capturing those on your inpatient admission so you can get credit for them. And there's numerous other agencies that use the Ehlers-Hauser comorbidities or a subset of those too. So very important to have your eyes on those. But the U.S. News and World Report methodology, again, if you have some spare time and want to gloss through 179 pages of life reading, there's a lot of information to unpack in there. With how they do their scoring and rankings of hospitals.
Yes, I agree. So we use it for the same purpose, the U.S. News rankings, and that is a big initiative for our hospital, just like other organizations. So that would be the main driver of having interest in the Ehlers-Hauser. But for those that are using other platforms like, you know, Vizient, Premier, Truven, Leapfrog, all of those things also use some form of Ehlers-Hauser comorbidities as well in their methodologies. No one gives us the exact science of how these Ehlers-Hausers are used and calculated and all of that, but we do know that it's used for the risk adjustment for that mortality score, and so that's why it's important. Sometimes people have asked me, you know, why do I need to start paying attention to Ehlers-Hausers? You know, where did these come from? And if your organization is not focused on some of these quality metrics in U.S. News, then that would definitely be a reason why you haven't started paying attention to them. But just so that you know, when it's time or if those things start to come about, then you're going to want to take a look at your Ehlers-Hauser comorbidities and your capture of them and your accuracy and your POAs.
And I just have one other thing to add, kind of going back to the U.S. news conversation. I think, you know, as Tiara mentioned, you know, you have Vizient and Premier and these other organizations. They're essentially usually looking at your data more, a little bit more in real time. One thing to call out with U.S. news that I'm not sure if everybody's aware of is that there is a rather large data lag. So I know sometimes we get the question of, well, why aren't we doing better in this area? You know, we implemented this new workflow a year ago. Well, U.S. News and World Report is a few years behind the current data that they used in the most recent rankings that were just released in July, you know, goes back to 2021 for some of those 12 data-driven specialties. So again, when you think back to what you were doing in, you know, 2021, 2022, 2023, it's probably very different than maybe what you're doing today. And so just keep in mind that it does take U.S. News and World Report, since they rely on the Medicare claims data. It takes them some time to catch up to your workflows that you're doing today and where you're hoping to see this impact.
That is a really good point. And also reminded me of something as well, that it used to be only based on standard Medicare patients that were 65 and older, where now it also includes your managed Medicare population. So there's a bigger pot of data that U.S. News is using in their methodology, where before it was small. So even if 3 years ago you just started your focus on Elixhauser, well, now you have a bigger population. So the methodologies are always changing, and the data is delayed. So there's not always a direct path to making, you know, quick and immediate fixes when it comes to some of that data. And this, there's no submission for this. It all comes from your MedPAR data. So that's why your claims, you know, what you've coded is what ends up on the claim. And we know there are limits on the claim. And so these Elixhausers are from your claims data.
Yeah. And just to add to that, Medicare Advantage edition just happened in July 2024. So last year was the first year that they used that data, and then they're going to continue with that.
Interesting. Thank you. So moving on to my next question. When it comes to coding and reporting these diagnoses, what are some key considerations that CDI specialists and also coding teams should keep in mind to ensure accuracy?
So you cannot just say, you know, you can't walk away from this podcast and say, okay, everybody start adding those Elixhausers. there's a lot more that has to go into it. So you know, coding needs some education to understand the importance of reporting these conditions, the importance of that accurate POA. And then CDI also needs to understand that as well, in addition to making sure the diagnosis is reportable. So we know that in order for a condition to be reported, it's not just that it's documented, but it needs to meet clinical significance, you know, based on the guidelines. So if you are querying for these as a CDI specialist, you need to make sure that clinical support is there. So we're not just adding a ton of codes that really weren't significant to the patient's stay. And that can get really tricky for people that are new into risk adjustment, because sometimes you may see that something is supported, but it's that extra step of proving the clinical significance that you want to make sure is at the forefront of, you know, your process. Same thing for educating your providers. You don't just want to start making them, you know, document all of these things. The clinical support for it also needs to be there.
Yeah, and I will just add, this has definitely been a hot topic as of lately, because we're finding many times patients may meet the definition clinically of a condition, but I'm always asking, well, what did we do about it? You know, what was the clinical evaluation? Was there any treatment? Was there associated procedures? Did it extend the length of stay? Or was there some sort of increase in the nursing or the nursing care or increased monitoring? You know, I think we all know most patients for some of these conditions, you know, get daily labs. So always asking the team, okay, daily labs essentially most of the time are routine. And so what did we do above and beyond that? You know, how did this affect the medical decision making of the provider? And that's where I think we usually have our opportunities, is trying to figure out, okay, yes, clinically this condition was present, but did we really do anything about it? Did it affect the care in some way for that patient? If it did not affect the care, it may be clinically present, but if it doesn't meet the UHDDS definition for reporting additional diagnoses, then we cannot add it to the claim.
Thank you. So could each of you share an example, perhaps, of an Ehlers-Danlos comorbidity and explain how you would ensure that it meets the UHDDS criteria for reporting?
Yeah, so thrombocytopenia is one example, and Amy and I have kind of talked about this one too, that we can identify when the platelet count is abnormal, right? There are standard parameters. It's, you know, usually 150 or less is going to meet the clinical definition of thrombocytopenia. But proving that clinical significance is where CDI really has to leverage that critical thinking and build a strong query in those instances. So things that you should be looking for: increased bleeding, or, you know, did the patient start having nosebleeds or gum bleeds or develop a GI bleed or something like that? Because we know that the thrombocytopenia from a clinical perspective can increase their risk of bleeding. Also, if they had some kind of procedure, even if it was a new central line or something like that, when they did that surgical assessment, did they have to possibly delay because the platelets were not in normal range? Or did anesthesia have to, you know, make note of that during their pre-procedure evaluation, where they're talking about, you know, no, we need to recover counts or something like that before you can proceed safely? Of course, your very obvious things, like if the patient gets a transfusion or something like that of the platelets, those are going to be more obvious. But some of the less obvious are going to be where it's impacted the care, such as adjustments to medication. For example, did we have to hold the heparin or hold Lovenox because the platelets were not within a normal range? Those are going to be things that you're going to find in your orders, or in your MAR, in your notes, and may say, you know, in the nursing note, because for our organization, as an example, when an order for DVT prophylaxis is placed, there is a range that the platelets need to be within. So if the platelets are not within that range and the nurse goes to give the medication, then the nurse would then put in a note saying, you know, medication held due to that, you know, not meeting for the platelets for today or something like that. So sometimes you might see that you have to do a little more digging to really make these queries stronger. But if you do your due diligence and you try to make a strong query and you really can't come up with anything, you just see that your platelets are 130, but no one increased any kind of monitoring, it didn't impact the patient at all, then you don't have anything that you can support a compliant query for that condition. So you have to make sure that you find all of that clinical support.
Yeah, and another thing to add is for some of these conditions, you likely need to consider coming up with some internal definitions and thresholds too. So similar to what Tiara talked about, the thrombocytopenia, you know, what's significant to your organization? One condition that we've spent a lot of time talking about is cachexia. So that is one that falls under the comorbidity for weight loss within Ehlers-Danlos. And so present on admission indicator status does matter. And when do we report cachexia? So a lot of times we were finding, you know, physicians would describe the patient as being cachectic. Okay, so that's how you're describing the patient, but is it clinically supported in some way? And then again, back to the UHDDS definition, what are we doing about it? How did it impact the care for that patient? And so I think we started a couple of years ago with what I would consider a relatively, you know, less stringent definition for cachexia, looking for some sort of muscle loss and some sort of chronic metabolic condition. And since then, we've expanded it a bit more. and really looking for patients that have a recent weight loss. The muscle wasting is still key, the presence of a metabolic condition. And I feel like this is a definition that honestly our team still goes back and forth on. And it's tough because cachexia is a sign or symptom code. So R64, it gets you the credit for the weight loss when present on the claim. And so you want to make sure that you're consistently reporting it for your organization and that your definitions align. There is quite a bit of literature out there if you, you know, do a deep dive review like we did. But I think really coming up with some internal guidance for your team to follow so that both the CDI and the coding teams are on the same page with the condition. And honestly, there's still questions today that are brought forward to our audit team to review and take a closer look at. And sometimes it's on a case-by-case basis if we feel we have enough support for that condition. But developing those internal guidelines and providing some examples of when we would query, you know, when we would code for it has really been helpful for the team. So I would encourage others to, you know, not look at just cachexia, but, you know, really go through that diagnosis list on the comorbidity mapping to see where you might have opportunities for reporting conditions maybe that you didn't think about or consider before, but maybe there is an opportunity. And chances are you need to provide some internal guidelines to the team to ensure that the reporting is consistent.
Thank you. This has been such a useful podcast. I'm learning so much. And I know we're running out of time, but I did want to ask one final question. So beyond justifying clinical significance, what other challenges or practical tips should teams consider when working with Alexhauser comorbidities in coding and documentation?
Yeah, so I'd say the biggest one that we kind of alluded to earlier with Tiara saying, you know, for example, U.S. News and World Report and, you know, maybe other insurance companies, if you have it within your contract, maybe doing some sort of risk adjustment, they're tied to the claims data. So even though other organizations that folks may partner with, like Vizient Premier, they may see all of your diagnosis codes. When we're talking like U.S. News and, again, these other groups that are just dealing with claims data, they're only getting what's on the claim form, which means that's 25 diagnosis codes and 6 procedure codes. And for those health systems that, you know, see really sick patients, really medically complicated patients, you know, it's very easy to have 50, 60 diagnosis codes for a patient that were actively, you know, treated during that particular stay. And so how do you ensure that the best 25 diagnosis codes go out on the claim for your patient? So I know we spend a lot of time looking at our code sequence, what's in the top 25 from a diagnosis perspective, but even on the procedure side, there's not as many opportunities for procedure sequencing. But when we're talking Alexhauser, the focus is really on the diagnosis side. And again, you know, we talked about that metastatic cancer. If that somehow would drop below 25, that could be a huge opportunity for your team to get that resequenced up, which I know normally falls with the coding team. So again, it's really important to ensure that, you know, the coding team is fully aware of the importance of some of these conditions, that especially if the CDI team is placing queries on the front end, that we actually report the diagnosis on the claim and get credit for that, especially when it's associated with mortality.
Yes, I agree with that. Everything that you said, Amy, that yes, that getting it on the claim in that top 25 is very important. It essentially doesn't count if you have it below that line. Some of these, like if you have more than one, then again, you can sequence one of them up at the top, you know, like obesity, for example, you might have credit for your obesity and for your BMI. You don't need both within your top 25, so you can make some room, but that requires a diligent effort to do that sequencing. Some of the softwares that people are using, they have some sequencing functionality in them. We use one of those to help you know, auto sequence for our conditions, making sure that our most important things are captured in that top 25. But that top 25 is prime real estate, right? So there are several competing factors, because it's not just the Elixhauser. It's going to be your MCCs and CCs and your SOI drivers and all of that. So there are a lot of things that are competing to be in that top 25. I'll also say that ensuring alignment in your organization is also a really big tip, because from the providers to CDI to coding, everyone needs to be in alignment with the reporting of the documentation and the reporting of these diagnoses, because they may not and usually will not impact your DRG, but they are still important for the sake of that Elixhauser risk adjustment. So you want to make sure that everyone understands that importance so that these conditions aren't missed. And then just to tie back to what Amy said before about developing those internal guidelines for consistency, because some of it is really vague. And the most important thing is accuracy. You don't want to over or under report these conditions. You want it to be accurate that when they are there and when they're clinically supported, that you have reported them with the appropriate POA. So I know Amy talked about cachexia, but like the abnormal weight loss as another example, it's another symptom code. What is abnormal weight loss? How do you define that at your organization? Because that's going to give you the same credit as a severe malnutrition, because they're in the same category of weight loss. So you want to make sure that you are reporting things accurately, and those internal guidelines are going to help you.
Well, thank you so much. This has been chock full of useful information. And I know this is a podcast that people will want to come back to again and again and listen to. So thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to be with us here today and sharing your expertise. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having us. Have a great day, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
And as always, if our audience has any questions about this topic, you can feel free to email the ACTIS team at info@actis.org. We will also put that email address in today's show notes, which are available on the show page at actis.org and in your podcast app, so you can grab it from wherever is convenient. And now for something completely different, the ACTIS Update, which is our regular segment featuring the latest news on what's going on inside your association. Both of our speakers today are on the ACTIS Leadership Council, and this podcast is a reminder that it's your last call to join us for the 2025-2026 cohort. This one-of-a-kind council is open for applications from leaders, managers, and anyone who has supervisory responsibilities. Please check the show notes for the link to apply, and don't miss out on submitting by the end of this month. So get your application in by the end of August so that you don't miss out. The other brief update I wanted to share is that we're getting so close to CDI week. This week of CDI recognition and fun runs from September 15th through the 19th. Keep an eye on actis.org for all the resources, tools, industry analysis, and fun that you need to celebrate this week in style. As always, you can find the link for all this information in today's show notes. Before we close out, each ACTIS podcast offers 0.5 ACTIS CEUs. To receive your 0.5 CEUs, go to the show page on ACTIS.org by clicking on the ACTIS podcast link under the free resources tab, and then click on today's episode from the list on that page. Then scroll down to the recording of today's episode and click play. You have to wait until the end of the video, like when the counter gets to zero, and that is when the link to the CEU evaluation will appear. You click on that link, take the survey, and your certificate will be automatically emailed to you once you have submitted the brief evaluation. These instructions are also on the show page, so you can follow along. To ensure your certificate reaches you and does not get trapped in your organization's spam filters, we do often suggest that you use a personal email address when you complete that CEU evaluation form. And to let you know, the cutoff for today's CEUs is Sunday, August 31st at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. After that point, the CEU period does close and you won't be able to earn any CEUs for this episode. However, you can always go back and re-listen and get any of the very, very useful information in any of our podcasts. but that CEU period is only for a few days after first airing. With that, we definitely have run out of time today. We will be back in 2 weeks on Wednesday, September 10th, with an episode giving us a sneak peek at some of the productivity data uncovered in this year's CDI Week Industry Survey. You want to receive reminders to make sure you never miss an episode? Just subscribe to our free weekly newsletter, CDI Strategies, which always includes a link to the next episode when it becomes available. You can listen to the show at absolutely any time, day or night, on the ACTIS website or via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite podcast app may be. All the links we discussed during today's episode will be available in the show notes. As always, please do, we really appreciate it if you would take a minute to leave us a 5-star review on your podcast app, as that will help others find our program and all the helpful information that we like to share. Our intro and outro music is Media Noche by D.E.N. Key, and our ad music is Take Me Higher by Jazzar, both obtained from the Free Music Archives. If you have any suggestions for future topics or guests or anything you want to talk with us about, simply email us at info@actis.org. And with that, I will say thank you for listening and goodbye.